Hi, this is Daniel Garb of the Movies for CulturalMoney.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. It's a cold winter day in January 1950 in Yukon. A U.S. military plane, the Douglas C-54D, known as the Skymaster, is flying between Montana and Alaska when it suddenly loses contact. Flight 2469 disappears from the skies, and when they search for survivors among the 44 crew and passengers, no one is found, and the plane itself has completely disappeared. What became of the Skymaster? Skymaster Down is a new in-depth feature-length look at the plane's disappearance and the friends and families of the missing crew and passengers today. Feature-length film is the work of award-winning documentarian Andrew Gregg. You may have heard him previously on this show talking about diverse topics, including the new far right in skinheads in 2017, problems in our prisons in state of incarceration in 2014, and new archaeological advances in the Norse, an Arctic mystery, way back in 2012. Well, I'm very pleased to have friend of the show, Andrew Gregg, back here once again via Zoom to tell us about another Arctic mystery, Skymaster Down, premiering tomorrow on CBC's documentary channel. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Daniel. Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me back on.
Yeah, and great to meet with you once again on CIUT's 35th anniversary, which is today, January 15th.
Amazing. That's amazing. This is an honor.
And I'm honored to have you here. So before seeing your documentary, I had never heard of the Skymaster and its disappearance. So what brought this flight to your attention?
I had done, you talk about the other documentaries I've done in the North, and I'd done one on ice patch archaeology in the Yukon in 2016. And I was back up at a film festival in Whitehorse in 2018 with that film. And I went to visit my friends at archaeology, and I noticed this pile of dented, beat up airplane parts sitting on a shelf in the archaeology storeroom. And I said, "What's that from?" And the archaeologist told me, "Oh, we found that last summer in the bush. We thought it was the missing Skymaster, but it wasn't." And I said, "What missing Skymaster?" And that's what started the whole thing. I think that that idea that everybody's forgotten, that virtually nobody knows about this anymore, is part of the story. It's incredible that a missing airplane with 44 people on board is missing somewhere in Canada, and yet most of us don't know about it.
So during the Cold War, this is 1950, the far north was strategic, geopolitical, and military zone that separates North America from the USSR, with the Dew Line, the Defense Early Warning Line, and the NORAD, the North American Air Defense Command, it was called at the time. And Alaska is physically separated by Canada from the rest of the continental U.S. So can you explain, in the context of the Cold War, why did the U.S. and Canadian government consider this particular air route so important?
I think to understand it, you have to go back to 1942, and after the fallout after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. They then attacked the Aleutian Islands off the tail off the west coast of Alaska, and America found itself with an undefended front line in the Second World War in Alaska. So they built the Alaska Highway, which was an incredible engineering feat when you consider that they got it done in just a few years. They plowed it through the wilderness, right up through British Columbia, through the Yukon, and right into Alaska. And when they did that, they also did a highway through the sky that mirrored the Alaska Highway on the ground. It was called the Northwest Staging Route. And that went from Anchorage right down to Great Falls, Montana. So the idea was that if you were stationed in Anchorage or Fairbanks, you'd get a flight from Anchorage down to Great Falls, and from there you'd go on to wherever you live in the lower 48. So when the Alaska Highway and the Northwest Staging Route went through, thousands upon thousands of people and so much ordnance, armaments, anything you can think of was shipped to Alaska to turn it into a front in the Second World War. At that point, the Russians were the Allies. come 1950, the Russians were the enemy. So they still kept the Alaska incredibly fortified, and there was a lot of people there at bases, mainly at Elmendorf in Anchorage, but also in Fairbanks. So these people, these 44 people on this flight on January 26, 1950, were simply going back home. They were simply heading to the lower 48, and all for different reasons, but that's all they were doing. This is pre-radar. So there are all these radio outposts along the ground underneath the flight path. And the crew's responsibility was to check in every half hour and give a report, whether there's icing on the wings or anything like that. So the crew of 2469 Skymaster checked in at all the Alaskan outposts, then crossed into Canadian airspace, checked in with the outpost at Snag, Alaska, which is now abandoned. They were supposed to check in a half hour later at another place called Asiak, and they never did. And that was the last that anybody heard of them when they checked in at Snag.
That route was already a hazardous one. Lots of planes went down there. But when the Skymaster disappeared in 1950, it was big news. Why was this important? Why weren't they able to find it?
Well, what happened, it was January 26th, so it was winter, and you're in the Arctic. I should mention, too, that the crew of seven on the Skymaster were all based in El Paso. These weren't necessarily seasoned northern aviators. But the route was very well marked. A matter of fact, other planes left that day from Anchorage and made it to Great Falls, no problem. When they checked in at Snag, the crew said that ice had been forming on the wings, but it wasn't a worry. The Skymaster wasn't pressurized, so with people on board, it couldn't fly any higher than 10,000 feet. There are mountains along the Northwest Staging Route that go up as high as 7,000 feet, but it still gives you enough clearance to make it through as long as you follow the rules and follow the instructions from the ground. My sense after looking at this all this time, and it's backed up by some eyewitness stuff, is that this crew might have thought they could take a shortcut. To cut across the flight path as opposed to keeping along it. If you do that, you're flying at 200, 250 miles an hour. That can put you into some of the biggest mountains of North America in the San Elias Range in no time at all. I've heard several theories. I've subscribed to several theories, but currently that's what I think happened. I think they thought they'd get cocky and they ended up flying into a mountain face and triggering a snowslide. That would have encased the plane and its passengers in ice. So with climate change and the melt happening, perhaps that's what's going to finally be able to reveal the plane. It's really hard to say.
Some people say with the new technology we've developed since the 1950s, it would be easy to find it if it happened now. But one obvious non-technological method they ignored was turning to the people who live there and who knew the land better than anyone else. I'm thinking of things like the lost ships of the Franklin expedition. A few years ago, they were found using Inuit knowledge. So why didn't they turn to the indigenous people in that area?
I think that it wasn't a blatant disregard for them. It definitely was an oversight. But when the plane went down on January 26th, or when it went missing, the U.S. and Canada were already preparing for war games that they were to be staged in the southern Yukon in the winter. So there were thousands of people in the Yukon already, all military people getting ready to stage these war games. And they didn't call it off. They kept it going. So when the plane went missing, there were soldiers that were parachuting and lighting off flares, all part of this training. And every time somebody heard a noise out there, they would phone it into the search headquarters and say, "I know where it is. It's north." So then they would send a plane out that way. And somebody else would say, "I know where it is. It's east." And so they'd send a plane out that way. And the planes they were sending out were big planes, DC-3s, C-54s, with small sort of porthole windows that would fog up and low-slung wings, which didn't allow you any visibility of the ground. Also at the time, modern search and rescue techniques were not in place. So there wasn't really a coordinated search effort. It was just throw more people at it, more planes at it. And the weather got really bad. It got really cold. The snow started falling. Four search planes crashed over the three-week search. It was basically a disaster. So after 3 weeks, what it says in the official accident report is that we're going to come back once the weather's better. But they just never did. They never went back.
Andrew Gregg, your documentary Skymaster Down takes you back to the place where the accident took place, or the general area. So how the movie is filled with these aerial shots. Did you use drones or planes or helicopters? How did you film this?
Drones. There's a tremendous drone operator, a friend of mine that I've worked with a few times in Whitehorse. He's probably the most talented drone operator I've ever seen. So that's all his work. And it was a major part of the story because we wanted to show off the Yukon landscape. I'm a former Yukoner myself, and I go back there a lot. I really wanted the audience to get a sense of the landscape and within its beauty to see also the danger.
It's spectacular, yeah.
Yeah, and you see, you know, like I say in the film, the Yukon, for all its beauty, is a land of wreckage. It's not only the gold rush wreckage that was left behind at the turn of the century, but in the rush to arm Alaska, so many airplanes crashed on the way up. They were being flown by green pilots who were ferrying fighter planes to the north. And there's a database, actually, in the Yukon of over 500 known crashes. And of those over 500, I think it's 508, they know where all of them are except for four. And the Skymaster is one of the four. So when you think about it, all of these other wrecks, they know where they are. They've been able to find them. Things turn up. But this one just remains stubbornly lost. And it's a conundrum. It really is frustrating. And that leads, you know, really to the plight of the families left behind.
You talked to a lot of the families left behind. Can you talk about one that you found particularly poignant? We only have a couple of minutes left.
Yeah, I think Judy Jackson in Alabama, whose father, Clarence Gibson, was the radio operator on the plane. Her mom was still pregnant with her when he went missing, so she never met him. But she spent her whole life, like somebody said to her, how can you miss something you've never had? And she says, I've missed my father all my life. She's done letter writing campaigns. She's even been to the Yukon, and she looked out in the wilderness, and her beautiful southern drawl says, oh, daddy, what happened to you? You know, it's just right out of a tragic novel. And all the families are this way. Well, all the rest of us have forgotten the story. It's still fresh in all their minds. And what we're our hope for is with the film is to bring this tragedy back into the public eye so that maybe the next steps can be taken to finally find this airplane and bring those people closure.
Well, it's a very interesting topic that very few people knew about before this documentary. Thanks so much for talking with me, Andrew.
Including me.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Andrew Gregg's documentary Skymaster Down premieres tomorrow, January 16th, on CBC's documentary channel, so don't miss it. This is Daniel Garber, the movies, each Saturday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and my website, culturalmining.com.